Happy holiday season. Merry Christmas to everyone listening.
Yeah, this is going to be like the final one of the year. I think this will be the final classic movies of the year. I don't see anything happening. Like, are we actually live here?
I'll just refresh the screen.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, we are. It says we're live. Yep, we're going. Yeah,
well, we're up and running there. So yeah, this is the final. Am I coming through there in the chat? Is everybody all right? Can you press one if I'm coming through all right in the chat there? I don't know where my man is. But yeah, afternoon all. Hello there. Grief's in the chat there. And we're live. Okay, there we are. Well, this is the final classic movies of the year. All right, cheers, lads. So this is the final classic movies of the year. I was intending to do Mad Max, but I thought let's do something a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more Christmassy. Although, you know, this is a bone of contention. Is it wholesome Americana or is it subversive? We'll get into all of that. I'm not too sure myself, if I'm honest. But I thought, it's a bit of a nice one to wrap up classic movies. So, how are you doing, Endeavor?
Pretty good. This was actually the first time I had seen Gremlin, so it came out before I was born, and it wasn't really a staple of the holiday season when I grew up. So I missed this one throughout my entire childhood, and maybe there's some good reasons for that. So this was actually a new one for me.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I'd put it into a context as well, so I don't have to kind of keep coming back on it like again and again. One of the things that I've because we touch on movies from different eras, and this is my favorite era of movies, is the 1980s. And one of the things that I've touched on before, but it is important, I think, is that when you get the Cultural Revolution in the 60s, and then in the 1970s, you get this, everything's like realist, everything's really gritty, everything's really depressing. All of them, I mean, don't get me wrong, they're great. There's some great films there in the 70s, but they are, it does have its certain sort of depression. And a lot of it is because it's kind of a hangover which is kicking in. So the boomers from the hippie era, they've by this time entered into all the institutions, and the cultural revolution's become sour. And now they've become part of the power structure, and all of the idealisms like draining out of them. And in a way, you can see that reflecting in all of the films that came out, you know, all of those political dramas, stuff like the Taxi Driver, The French Connection. And what you see, it eventually kind of jaws breaks through the ice, and there's a more of a positive vision begins to emerge, and then Star Wars as well. And then, of course, when you get into the 1980s proper, Ronald Reagan's in office, and I don't want to go on too much of a tangent, but what you tend to see is that in the 1980s, it's a very positive time. It's a very uplifting time. And I think part of the reason is that the Cold War was still dragging on. And I think there was a lot of people in the American deep state, you know, and they were getting in cahoots with people in Hollywood. And they were saying, look, we can't have all of this navel-gazing, dumping on America style stuff coming out, because we are in a kind of ideological and cultural Cold War with the Soviet Union. It's no good to be constantly undermining ourselves and our institutions. And when you get Ronald Reagan coming in, there's a stark shift in tone in what's coming out in Hollywood. So you straight away you get into even something like Rocky, which we'll probably review next year. You begin to see in the late 70s that something more of a positive American ideal comes in with Rocky. There's Star Wars uplifting. Jaws paints a good sort of wholesome picture of Americana. And then what more, you get Indiana Jones. There was so many. So to get back to Gremlins, I think Gremlins, in which came out in 1984, is this. Because on the one hand, it represents this really wholesome, like the town in Gremlins at Christmas, it's just pure Americana. It looks like heaven on earth. And this is the America which I grew up with. It was looking at these things, you know, like the America of Back to the Future, of Gremlins, of the Burbs, of the Goonies, all of these. And it's all throughout the 1980s. It just looked great. It looked like the most fun, wholesome place ever to be. And of course, there's Gremlins itself has got some commentary on that, which we'll get into. But I just wanted to sort of set the scene of where Gremlins fits into a wider picture. You know, would you agree with that endeavor?
Well, yeah, you definitely see that in the 1980s. It kind of is this resurgence in American patriotism, albeit kind of a bit more of a plastic and a disingenuous version of it. But, you know, it's still there. And you still get that feeling from a lot of these movies. You mentioned Rocky earlier. I actually had like a really interesting take. I had a really maybe out there take on the movie Rocky IV. You know, the one where he fights the Russian guy, that basically like you see like the message on the surface is that, well, Rocky is the American hero who goes over to Russia and, you know, beats up the Soviet guy. But then, you know, the thing I thought was funny about it was about Rocky IV, and maybe we'll do that one eventually. But it's like the bad guy's this like hulking Aryan square jawed blonde hair, blue eye guy, and the Soviets are talking about his like genetic superiority and stuff like that. So you see how they get like the civic nationalism in there, the patriotism, but then they also kind of slip in the more deep subversion just underneath that. And I kind of felt that way with Gremlins as well, because there are a lot of things in the film that are really wholesome. But then there's also some things that, you know, they really aren't. There's a lot to get into in that regard.
Yeah.
As far as like the town, though, that you mentioned, I really do love the town. I do love the Americana small town. And it's also been common, you know, over the decades for rural Americans to take a beating from Hollywood. But this one actually is quite sympathetic to them, certainly more than others.
And in general, in the 1980s, because this will pop up a few times in Gremlins, I think, you see that it was as if America has actually solved a lot of the issues of the decades earlier, and this is why you see like civic nationalism in there. So it's kind of fake. It doesn't really reflect the real world. It's more of an idealized form of America, which you see there. So you do, like in Gremlins, you do have like the black scientist guy, but when you actually, he's also the first to die, but it's not so much political correctness as a kind of racelessness, where you we're beyond that. And of course, this is what the classic liberals kind of lament. But before we get going, he has, just to of an era of movies. So Gremlins came out in 1984. Okay. So I just did a Google movies of 1984. So he has a brief summary of some of the movies which came out just in 1984. There's Neverending Story, Footloose, Once Upon a Time in America, Gremlins, Purple Rain, Amadeus, Beverly Hills Cop, The Terminator, Karate Kid, 1984 itself, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Splash, Dune, Ghostbusters, The Woman in Red, Police Academy, Top Secret. It just goes on. Children of the Corn, it just, Revenge of the Nerds, Supergirl, The Bounty with Anthony Hopkins and Mel Gibson, that's a great one. The Last Starfighter. I mean, good God, Greystoke, the Tarzan movie, which came out, it just goes on. Red Dawn, what a year. From what came out this year? Like, what movies came out? How many movies? Name me one movie which came out this year, which could compete with any one of those that I've just listed out. And if you went into 1983, you'd get something similar. If you'd go into 1985, it was throughout the whole 80s. Just good film after film after film, all in one year. And you get now, and it's just, what do we have this year? Like that new Batman thing, for God's sake. So, yeah, it's a bit of a tangent there. But just you can see like the quality of the movies that came out, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely. I watched one new movie this year. I watched the new rendition of the Agatha Christie book, the Hercule Poirot, A Death on the Nile, and it was woke trash. It was a total waste of time. So yeah, I can't think of a single movie this year that's going to be memorable to anyone really. So. Yeah, I mean, they certainly were spoiled for choice. And it also does kind of speak to how, like, just how much power Hollywood really had at the time. I mean, they still have a lot of power, but I do feel that, you know, a lot of them, they have declined significantly, though, because, you know, Hollywood isn't the same cultural phenomenon that it was several decades ago. Like, there isn't that big movie that everyone goes to and everyone talks about. All the kids talk about it at school. All the guys talk about it at their office or at the gym or something like that. We don't really have that anymore.
No, not at all. Everything's been, everything's atomized. Everything's been broken apart. Everything's, I mean, this is a bit of a longer tangent than we normally do to get in, but I think it's good to sort of set the stage, as it were. So, I mean, Gremlins itself, the story isn't all that complicated. It's, it begins, let's get the story out of the way and then we can go back over it. So basically, an inventor is in Chinatown and he finds this weird little teddy bear type creature, and it's on the run up to Christmas, and he buys it and then he wants to bring it home. He's given a warning before leaving the shop that he's not allowed to, what is it now? You're not allowed to get it wet. You're never, ever allowed to feed it after midnight. And it has to stay away from sunlight. So he brings it back to this idyllic little town where he lives, which is all snow and all just perfect. And everybody knows each other and everything. And, of course, they break every single one of the rules. And the little teddy bear thing turns into, like, gremlins, little demonic monsters, and they trash the whole town, and that's kind of it. The story's not that complicated, but I think there's quite a few layers with interesting things going on with it, and really it is a question of because it's a Christmas movie, or is it not a Christmas movie? And I think it is a Christmas movie, if I'm honest. What do you think about, let's talk about the idea that it's set before, just like associated with Christmas.
Well, for me, I didn't really see why it needed to be a Christmas movie, because this plot could easily have been written and take place in the same town, not during Christmas or at any other time of the year. So, I mean, to me, I didn't really see the real Christmas in the movie. You know, like the toy wasn't opened on Christmas. Oh, the gremlin, the gift that he gave to his son. It wasn't opened on Christmas. Yeah, I mean, it just didn't really seem very like Christmassy to me. And there wasn't really that much about them like celebrating Christmas. I know that it took place on Christmas Eve, but that's, you know, kind of typical for any movie that is set at the time. I didn't really get the Christmas in it, though. I can see, you know, maybe with some of the other aspects of the film, some of the more subversive ones, that, you know, it definitely played into that in that it allowed them to, you know, push some things which probably weren't really very friendly to the kids who this movie was marketed to. But yeah, I don't know if I'd say it's a Christmas movie, though. I mean, it certainly takes place during one, but I don't see why it had to be Christmas.
I mean, it is. You can be a little bit cynical, and I think like Mariah Carey earns like $300,000 a year from the royalties from that awful Christmas song that comes out. And if you bring out a movie or a toy or a song or something which is associated with Christmas, then you're guaranteed royalties. And especially when it's something like Gremlins, because you got the Gremlins and Mogwai toys were a thing. I remember seeing the little Gremlins. It was like a rubbery thing, which you could move its arms and its legs, and then the Mogwai would be like something that the girls would like. So you've got the marketing in there as well. But it is kind of, there are some scenes in it where it does make you kind of, you know, you do get the scene where, well, hold on, let me take a step back. Because of who runs Hollywood, I'm on YouTube, so we'll leave it at that. Because there's a talk which goes something like, there's an idea that the Hollywood movies deliberately want to undermine and trash Christmas because it's Christian, because it's a Christian tradition and Christian celebration. So when you have a look at the kind of people who run Hollywood, and you have a look at some of the stuff which comes out of Hollywood, you can say that, well, if you wanted that they're trashing Christmas. But if you wanted to go another layer deeper, you could also say that they invented how we think about Christmas via Hollywood in the modern era as well.
Yeah, because one thing you'll notice is that in Gremlins, there's never a single mention of Christianity in the entire movie. They never mention Jesus. They never mention the Nativity, any of that. I don't think there's any clips of a church. There's nothing about Christianity in this movie that's about Christmas. But that's actually quite common in Hollywood movies. Most of them don't have anything.
I mean, to be fair, it's common in the real world as well. I'm not sure about America in the 1980s, but it was common enough in the 1980s in England that there just wouldn't be much Christianity in Christmas. I mean,
it's certainly the case now. Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, this is a wider kind of theme of Gremlins. So the story's not complicated, but when you look at some of the subtext and some of the themes in it, so you can begin with the fact that Mr. Peltzer, which is a funny kind of name, isn't it? He is an inventor, and he's walking around. He's kind of traveling around hawking all of these, like, he's invented all of these contraptions, like the bathroom buddy, and it's like a Swiss Army knife, but it's everything that you need to shave and brush your teeth and all this. And it's crap as well. Like, it's just such rubbish that everything goes wrong. The stuff that he's got, like a machine for making orange juice, which is just garbage. It sprays all over the place. The house, I mean, it is endearing. It is funny when you see, like, the house is just completely swamped with all these rubbish contraptions that don't work. None of them work. Like contraptions to make, like, crack eggs open. It just makes all the shell go in the bowl. And his wife's even got a thing. It's like a receiver thing, and it's supposed to be where she doesn't have to answer the phone, but it doesn't work, so she uses the aerial of it to pick the phone up. And there's all these nice little touches in Gremlins there, because it's making you invest in the world straight away. But it's also a wider point that it's a very kind of materialist and consumerist culture, which is a kind of thing which is going right to the heart of this movie, I think.
Yeah, and we, as you mentioned earlier, it takes place during the Ronald Reagan era, and the critique of Reaganism and of Americanism in that time was that it was soulless consumer capitalism based on greed, and you certainly see that throughout the movie. For example, like the dad you mentioned, he's always trying to make a buck. Like, he's trying to sell his inventions, which don't work, to anybody who listens. There's that one scene near the beginning where there's that, what is that woman's job? Is she like, does she work at the bank? Is she a rentier or what is
Mrs. Beagle?
Yeah. What does she do again?
She's some kind of property owner, and yeah. she's got like a scam going on with the bank where they're able to fiddle around and rip people off or something like that. I don't think it matters too much. She's just like, she's kind of just Scrooge in this particular Christmas tale.
Yeah, so basically there's a part at the beginning where there's a woman saying, oh, can you please give me a break? It's Christmas Eve. I can't afford to pay it now. And she says, well, we're about making money every day, and we don't rest for Christmas, or something to that effect. And then, like, to show how cartoonish and over the top she is, there's even a scene in the bank where she says she's going to kill the main character's dog. You know, it's like, you're so evil that you say you're going to kill someone's dog. I mean, it's quite funny. But that's a very common trope in the 1980s, that the critique of Reaganism is that, like, you know, it's based on greed. It's so capitalistic. It's all about the money. And it's very common for the villain in 80s and 90s movies to be some rich asshole who really only cares about who only cares about money, and that's a very common trope of the time. And you see that with the dad, you see that with this woman, you see that throughout the movie.
One of the reasons you'll see it in so often in Hollywood and places like that is because it was a left wing. This is before the left sold their souls and became the kind of freakish abomination that they are now. So back in the 80s, the neoliberalism, which came in, especially with Reagan, this hyper-consumption and kind of grifting, that was associated with like a particular sort of right-wing, almost like libertarian brand of Americanism, which then spread with Thatcher and into Britain. And so the left, a lot of the stuff that you'll see that came out of that era is from the left. So it's a left-wing critique of like materialism and this form of hyper-capitalism. And so this is why they got away with it quite a bit. I mean, fast forward where we are now, and good God, have the tables turned, because it's people like us who say, oh, it's also shallow, it's also, you know. And you'll also see, just sticking with the beginning of the movie, is, of course, he's gone into he's gone to Chinatown, and it's very old world. It's very kind of mystical and magical, and it you don't really understand it. And what he does is he picks up what he calls Gizmo, is the Mogwai, and he offers the Chinese man behind the counter like $100, and then he doesn't want to sell it, and then it's, oh, I'll give you $200 or $300. And what's happened is that this kind of magical creature has been reduced to nothing but a consumer item to be bought and then handed around for like a tacky Christmas present. And there's a kind of sense that the Chinese man understands this. He tries to tell them, you know, you don't understand. You're out of touch with the natural world. So there is that. There is that in there. I mean, the kind of the mysticism of China, you see it quite a lot in the 1980s as well, where it's like the America represents this new materialistic consumer but shallow culture, which is kind of like just buying up the planet. But then a frame of reference outside of that is like China, especially India, they did that to some degree as well. Not so much the Islamic world, but these are kind of like enchanted places, more mystical places, which are in opposition to the American materialism. It's funny because, like, you know, this is the Cold War going on in the background as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you see in a lot of these movies that it's kind of a recurring trope of the time as well, 80s, 90s, which is, you know, kind of an anti-white trope, if I'm being honest. It's that, like, they'll show that the Westerners, especially Americans, like, they're the ones who are ignorant, consumeristic, nihilistic, and their lives are really shallow, while the people off in the East, they're majestic, they're wise, they have this deep, rich culture and tradition. And, like, it kind of is this, I think this kind of is what gave rise to the notion, which is repeated often today, that, oh, well, white people have no culture, which obviously is just patently ridiculous. And then also the Gen Xers and the millennials, you know, how as soon as they hit 20, they went off to India to quote unquote find themselves, because they wanted to find, like, they had this idea that there was this authentic culture out there, which didn't exist in the Western world. Although it is, like, you know, it's kind of a lie to say that China is like this deep, rich, traditional, majestic society, because, I mean, if we're going to look at China in the second half of the 20th century, I mean, they, like, uprooted their culture absolutely brutally. They burned all of the teachings of Confucius and killed all these, like, intellectuals. And I mean, it was horrible, like, during the Cultural Revolution. So if Americans had, had a shallow and hollow culture. Well, I don't know what you'd call that. And then the other irony is that today, you know, I think maybe you could say in the 80s and 90s that, and I was not really around for this time. I was born in the mid 90s, so I can't really remember it very well. But, you know, I even saw this in my childhood in the early 2000s, is that Western people kind of seem to be on this high of consumerism that, especially like after the Cold War ended, and it was like, well, it's Francis Fukuyama's end of history. We're all just going to, you know, it's just going to be awesome Nintendo games from here on in. And that's the pinnacle of human achievement. But what we see now these days, I think, is that there's, and maybe we can't really articulate it. Maybe the masses can't articulate it, but it feels like in the West, people have really become jaded with this consumerism, and it's really just vapid. And I think they've had enough of it. But if you look at China, China's like, it's incredible how consumeristic they are these days. Like they are, Gremlins was parodying, in America back in the 80s. China is like that today, perhaps to an even greater degree. Like they absolutely love to shop. They've just got their first taste of it, and they're addicted to that drug.
Yeah, and I think some of the geopolitics bros would probably point out that at this point, they were kind of cozying up to China. You know, I think it's this, when, what year was it that Nixon, it would have been about 10 years or so earlier when they had the big fallout with Nixon going over. And then you could see that they were, one of the things that they wanted to happen at that time was to outsource a lot of the production to China. It was still a little way off, but the feelers were going out to China long ago. So I think in the content that they had, they didn't want to alienate the Chinese in the way, for example, the way that they would treat the Russians, the way that you'd see the Ivan Drago type people, Red Heat. You can see that there's a connection between like the deep state and the State Department and like Hollywood content. Maybe not so much today because nobody watches it anymore. It's just like this forced indoctrination, woke stuff. Like we are the target. Like we are the people to be bashed with it. We are like the Russians, you know. We are the ones that just have to be brainwashed with it, the enemy. Whereas in the past, you can see that a lot of the sort of long-term objectives are kind of reflected in some of the Hollywood content as well.
Yeah, and to give credit where credit's due, like, you know, it is you could say that it is kind of like this anti-white trope of like the mystical Chinese, the mystical Easterners versus like those consumeristic culturalist whites who are ignorant and stupid. But there is actually something to the critique that the movie directs towards Americanism and consumerism. Like there's that scene at the end where the Chinese man, the old Chinese guy, comes back and takes the Gizmo, the gremlin, or whatever they called the monster before it turned into the gremlins. He comes back and takes and he scolds them for allowing the creature to watch TV. And it's like hinting that, yeah, the TV is poison. And, you know, in the long run, that has been proven to be correct. And, you know, looking back on it, it was kind of the resurgence of patriotism and under Ronald Reagan. Was it really that deep? And I get the feeling that like it might have been fun to be around at the time. You know, I'm sure that people would have. I'm sure living in America would have been really would have been great in that time period. But it does look very shallow these days. Like when I look back at that, it does seem like it's really it's really paper thin, and it's no wonder that it weathered away so quickly.
I mean, somebody Hunky Haggis sent me a coffee. Yesterday, you know, before the stream, I even organized it hardly. But ahead of the stream, he says, please read out on Gremlin stream. Do you see any similarities in the overall meta vibe between the 80s and the 50s? There was a certain sense of don't take yourself too seriously and optimism in some of the 80s stuff. So, yeah, this is kind of what we're getting onto. And I think what you have, and I also agree that you have the positive, genuine Americana of the 50s, and then you go through the filter, the meat grinder of the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s, the Depression sets in the 70s, and then in the 80s, it's like there's an attempt to kind of get back. What would be, you, people these days, they say, like, get back to French Prince, meaning the 90s. In the 80s, it was like they wanted to get back to Rawhide or whatever it was. So, and it worked. It worked. But what you see is that there's the postmodernism is kind of, and the cynicism of it, because it's aware of itself. I mean, in the 80s, you also saw like James Dean made this huge comeback, even though he'd been dead for 30 years. So in many ways, the 1980s was a kind of reification and nostalgia for the 1950s. And you see it in something like Gremlins, in the way that the town is presented. The town itself they're not saying the town is institutionally racist or anything. The town itself is never under attack. The kind of lovely, the snow on this, you know, you open, you've got the local sheriff, the cop is like, you know, giving a young lad a clip on the ear because he's monkeying around with the Christmas trees. There's a little bit of banter goes on with the locals in the where they're buying the Christmas trees. And you get this whole kind of opening scene just sort of introducing you to the town and all of the people wandering around it. So much so that it actually reminds me a lot of The Truman Show, which came later, where it's like the perfect American town, small town, where everything is in its right place. Everybody knows each other's names. There's a hierarchy, so the policeman gets respect, and everything's just perfect. And in The Truman Show, of course, that's created. It's like, in the same way that the Gremlins one is, it's a work of fiction. But in The Truman Show, it's been deliberately created. In Gremlins, it's kind of a recreation of an earlier, more innocent America, which, to be fair, probably still did exist in the 1980s. But you'll see that kind of trope throughout the 1980s. It's also in the 70s, you'll see a lot of the movies are in the big cities. You know, it's New York and San Francisco and all of this. And again, in the 80s, you move out, you go to the suburbs. You're actually out in flyover country, America, and it looks great. So another thing that which has slipped in, of course, is that there's a kind of deconstruction going on at the same time. And it's strange to see it. And this is why Gremlins, on the one hand, it presents this uncritical view of America, an idealized version of it. But on the other hand, it is, in a typical like Gen X kind of way, it is undermining that at the same time. So you get both. Eventually, the criticism would just end up dominating everything. So if you think of somebody like the dad in this, Mr. Peltzer, who he's got all of these useless inventions, but he's more like a lovable buffoon than authority figure. In the 1950s, the father was an authority figure. The authority's been removed from him and kind of placed onto the youth, onto the son, which is just more destructive than what people might think, because it decapitates the hierarchical nature of the family, the patriarchy. But then I think you can also see that in Mr. Peltzer, what, 7 years later maybe, or even just five, in that kind of lovable buffoon archetype would be Homer Simpson. In my opinion, the criticism of America would become a little bit more vicious. And then you end up where it leads to something like South Park, where it's just like an all-out humiliation.
Yeah, I mean, there is that trope of the American dad being a complete moron. That's something that you do see throughout pop culture in the late 20th century and the early 21st. Like, I can think of Family Guy, Homer Simpson, The Simpsons, the show Malcolm in the Middle, which came out in the 2000s. It definitely played into that. And yeah, I mean, it is a pretty subversive trope because it is like, I mean, it's like denigrating like the guy who's supposed to be the leader of the family, the one who's supposed to be taking responsibility. However, like in this one, it's kind of like on the first notch, whereas later on that gets like turned way up. It gets turned up as the time goes on. But yeah, like this one's kind of like the very beginning of this trope of the lovable buffoon. The other thing was that about it's not like deconstructing America to the same degree as things today, which are just like all out assault. Going back to that red tier lady, the one that like was like the cruel woman who wouldn't give her tenant the break on Christmas Eve. Like I mentioned earlier, the rich asshole being like the villain in a lot of these 80s movies, kind of as a critique of the you know, shrewd soulless capitalism of the Reagan era. Most of the villains were white, but they weren't like bad for being white. You know, like that wasn't that wasn't the source of their villainy. So, and usually their victims were as well. So it didn't have the same like racial overtones as it does today. And you could, you could just imagine how something like this would be done today. Like, for example, this character in this 80s movie, this horrible old woman, if one of the characters like slapped her in the face or something like that, that would be seen as like just desserts, that she was this horrible, rich old woman who only cared about money, and she got slapped in the face, and then that's and she got what she deserved. Now, you know, you can see the villains that they have in these movies today. But I recently watched this other movie, which was not so great. It was called The Grand Budapest Hotel, and it was not much to talk about. But like basically at the end, like the main character is some guy from like Turkey or India, some non-white guy who ends up being like extremely rich. You know, like could somebody who ended up owning the hotel, could a white guy who worked in the kitchen of that hotel, who was not doing very well at his job, or he was kind of like depressed, could he go up there and like slap his boss in the face? Well, then under contemporary culture, the white working class guy who slapped the rich, powerful non-white guy, he would be labeled the villain. He would be the bad guy. Whereas in the 1980s, it was still kind of a left-wing critique, but it was one that was based around class, which, you know, used to be what the left, that used to be the what the left's medium for advancing their agenda. Today, that certainly isn't the case anymore. So, you know, you do see that like the villains there, but it isn't like, I don't feel like this character is meant to show that all of America is evil, whereas today, with the villains you see in the movies, that is clearly the message.
Yeah, and so all of the rules get broken, and the gremlins are unleashed, and they're led up by the one with a stripe. He the only reason he's got like a stripe on his hair is so that you can recognize him from the rest of them. And there's this scene where, just to actually get into the movie proper as well, the scene where they actually kind of hatch and then it's in the house. I really forgot how brutal that was. And I watched this as a little boy. There's like, so help me out, because I'm trying to think of the disgusting ways that first of all, the gremlins attack Billy's mother. So you've got the mother is under attack from these little monsters and having her face scratched, and then there's one goes into a food blender and it's eating the ingredients from the food blender, so she turns it on and blends it, and you see its legs like wriggling, and then Billy she gets attacked, she's getting strangled with the Christmas lights, it comes out the Christmas tree. And then she's on the ground, and it's like almost strangling to death with the Christmas lights. And Billy comes in and chops its head off with the sword. And then you see its head burning as it screams in the fire. And then the other one is where one of them, it's inside the microwave, and she just closes the door and switches it on full. And you see it being microwaved and then exploding into a mush inside of it all. And I thought, by God, these 80s movies didn't, they were really rough. When you look, I mean, even Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, at the end, when you see all of the Nazis get melted by the Hebrew spirit, which is, well, that's a topic for, I'm not going to get into on this one, but basically just the sheer violence of it, of their faces melting. That, I think that would have to be an Odyssey special when we do that one.
Indiana Jones was my favorite movie as a kid. That scene always scared the shit out of me, though.
Yeah.
That scene with the melting faces.
Yeah, it's horrific. That's great.
And then there's the second one where he rips the guy's heart out, literally.
Yeah, it's really gruesome. There's somebody else, the propeller. It's Pat Roach was a Welsh. I think he was English. I think he was from Bristol or Birmingham, or he's from the big. He's a big old bruiser, and he's in all three of the original Indiana Jones movie. And he gets chopped up by a propeller. He smacks Indiana Jones all around the place and gets. The aeroplane propeller goes into him, and you just see like a blood splat across the.
Oh yeah, I also winced at that scene every time. Yeah,
and I mean just back to Gremlins. There's a lot of it is so gory. I mean I think at the time when it came out, it was classified as a 15, but because of the nature of it, because it was a Christmas movie, and it had these little monsters. Parents just didn't care. It was like parents would just sit the kids down and they'd all watch it, and it was fine. But even like the stuff where like Stripe jumped, it is to be fair, it is great the way they do it, where you've seen what happens when they get a cup full of water splashed on them and there's like five new ones. And then Billy's chasing Stripe through like the sports center. And then Stripe jumps into the swimming pool, and all of the water turns to vapor, and there's flashing lights, and you hear these weird, creepy noises, and it's just this holy shit, this is gonna go wild, and he does a runner, and there's the Futtermans, we'll get onto Mr. Futterman in a minute, but they get the Gremlins drive a bulldozer into their house. And they're not messing around, like they get squished, and they're screaming as it happens. You've then got the black scientist guy who also gets a painful death, and then he gets injected. What you'll find is that what the people are like tends to come back on them. It tends to like the Mr. Futterman. So the Gremlins themselves. The idea of a gremlin came from World War II, when it was to explain why things were going wrong with technology. I mean, there's a whole aspect with technology which we haven't even touched on, but the gremlins were in World War II. If something went wrong with an airplane engine or something, they would say, oh, the gremlins have been at it again. Mr. Futterman was there, and he's had this paranoia ever since about foreign cars, foreign machinery coming into America, and that it would be, they'd have like gremlins in it. And he's kind of connected the two. And of course, he's really proud of his all-American, is it like a bulldozer or a tractor? Eventually, of course, it's like literally gremlins are driving it in through his house and killing him and his wife. It's like, it's actually come back to him like karma. The black scientist guy, he gets injected. He injects the Mogwai, and then that's how he dies, and so on. So there's a kind of karma in the way that they die. I'm not too sure about the old woman. Like she gets she's on her stair lift thing. It just so happens she's got like a long curved staircase, and she sits on a seat and goes up. And of course, they kind of fiddle about with the wiring, so she ends up getting like blasted out of the window. But at the end of the day, at the end of the day, you are looking at an old woman like being launched through the top window, and like dying, like landing with a thud on the ground for the laughs, you know, for the laughs. This is all pretty, pretty. It's pretty violent, to be honest. I think it's part of a wider Gen X thing, which maybe I'll get onto in a bit later. But, yeah.
Well, about the rating of the movie, I actually just looked this up, and because I remembered it being hearing that it was marketed as a kids movie. Of course, I wasn't alive at the time, but so I looked it up, and it said that it was original. This and Temple of Doom, well, Indiana Jones, were marketed as PG, so the rating parental guidance. But there at the time they had no distinction between PG and PG-13. So PG-13 didn't exist yet, and there was just PG and then R. Whereas, you know, there were some movies that were like really that were PG, which just had really mild themes in that, but not bad enough to be rated R. And I heard that, and I read that this is actually why they created the PG-13 rating, this movie and Temple of Doom, because of how violent they were. They weren't violent enough to be rated R, but they certainly weren't meant. They certainly weren't something that you would want to see a kid under 13 to go see in the theaters. So it actually did have a pretty big impact because on the way that they rated movies and who's allowed to see them. Because I mean, I would definitely not allow a kid under the age of 13 to watch this movie because like there's a scene where the gremlin literally gets blown up in a microwave. Like my goodness,
and shortly after all the chaos happens as well, all of the gremlins go into a cinema. First of all, there's a bar scene, and it's got like the girl, I can't remember her name, and she's kind of like Billy's girlfriend, basically, and she's working behind the bar, and all the lights are low, and they're all in there, and you get this kind of montage of tropes. This is where you can see the postmodernism slipping in because they've got like one of the gremlins as it looks like a transsexual because it's in like jogging pants, but it's and that's going to get me in trouble with Susan, isn't it? Will I get away with that? But it's kind of like it's got like because these aerobics, like jogging on the spot, and these aerobics. That was associated with women, but it's obviously a gremlin that's wearing it, you know what I mean? And then you've got like Stripe and the Top Boys like smoking cigars and all of this kind of thing. But one thing, yeah, I've got to touch on something here before I carry on, because one of the things that in the bar scene in particular, it's where it hits home. There's, if you go on the Wikipedia, yeah, there's a flash of gremlin, but if you actually take a look at the Wikipedia, and I'm walking on eggshells here, okay, so I know I'm on YouTube, I'm walking on eggshells, but there's a trope that Gremlins is actually about, let's just say, the inner city youth of America, because they eat chicken, they are scared of water, and they are, like, so you have this, like, picture perfect small town America, and when they are released into small town America, the whole like civilization collapses, and there's all these different tropes, and this has actually been a long running bone of contention. This is if you go on the Wikipedia page of Gremlins, you will see what I'm talking about. This was picked up. And it's like, well, this is a deeply and profoundly racist movie. Now, I'm not gonna get into that any further on YouTube, but it is a thing, it is a trope. Eh?
Oh yeah, I definitely noticed that you know it's the idyllic town which has been invaded by something foreign, and now all hell breaks loose. Kind of like some countries in the world we can think of today in the West, but we don't need to go too far deep into that. But like, I think though that they actually tried to like debunk that, kind of like dispel that kind of interpretation, because I did think about that while watching the movie. Like, you could actually interpretate this to be a really based movie in that regard. But they have that scene with, what's the guy's name? Mr. Someone, the old drunk guy that, I mean, he his thing is that, what's his name again? I forgot his name.
Futterman,
yeah. So his thing is that he's always like ranting about foreigners. He's always ranting about foreigners and foreign-made cars and anything foreign. And because you could see you could interpret the movie Gremlin as like an invasion of foreigners into a idyllic land. But then they put this in, which I think, you know, for many people will kind of dispel that interpretation because, well, this is like the drunk, racist, old white man who's ranting about foreigners and he's stupid. And then that can't be the interpretation. And then secondly, they also have the Gizmo, like the one that doesn't turn into the gremlin. And he's like the exception. So he's the one that that doesn't turn evil and that, oh, well, he can be integrated because he's good. So they do kind of put a few things in that could maybe either cover them from that kind of accusation, or maybe because they didn't want the film to be interpreted as based. I don't know what.
I don't think that was the intention of the people doing the movie to put that message in that the about the urban youth at all. I think that's been picked up on by others and used similarly to Danny DeVito as the Penguin. And if there's a whole story about that as well, where people saw Danny DeVito. I'm walking on thin eggs here. Like, people saw Danny DeVito's depiction of the Penguin. He is this mogul. You know, just if you have a look at what he actually looks like, he arrives in a crib. He's wants to kill the firstborn of Gotham. He manipulates the political processes and the media with his money. There's a lot of tropes there as well. And that was all, like Gremlins, that was also picked up on. And people are saying, hang on a minute. Like, what is it that you're saying? But I think it goes more about the sort of people just being a bit paranoid or wanting something to complain about. I mean, in Gremlins, I'm definitely saying it wasn't intended. The Tim Burton Batman, that's, I don't know. I'll give it a, I don't know. We'll have to get into that another day. But so what happens? What I was leading to as well is the way that like they're in the cinema and watching Snow White, isn't it? And the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah.
And Billy like locks them in, then just burns them all alive. It's just like vermin. It actually reminded me of the scene in Inglourious Basterds as well, because they do that, don't they? I don't know. The point is after this long sort of tangent, it is gruesome, like it is like literally just killing, which I don't think you see that in its stuff these days. But throughout the 80s, this there was a casual kind of promotion to violence with four kids. Even something like Empire Strikes Back is quite brutal. You know? I mean, he really does get his hand chopped off and loses brutally and all of this. And I think it had a kind of hardening attitude on a lot of the sort of Gen X types as well. And maybe this is where the cynicism came in. Another thing that you'll notice in Gremlins, which happens throughout, is that there's a lot, like you see, there's a, Billy falls asleep and he's watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers. There's the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs come in, and A Wonderful Life, if you notice.
Yes.
And the town's actually similar to A Wonderful Life.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So you like, get these.
They even have the movie hall on like the main street.
Yeah. So you get this kind of thing where it's using like images from movies in the movie, which again at that time would seem clever. There's a lot of allusions because Spielberg was a producer, and you see a lot of allusions. Like Stripe pops out from, and like there's a thing of E.T., which had come out the year before, and there's an E.T. like toy. And Stripe's hiding behind it. And there's a lot of allusions to that as well, like Steven Spielberg's other movies in it as well.
Yeah, I didn't catch that part.
And right at the beginning, there's the person who, the business which is selling the Christmas trees, his advert for his like business, it's him. But he's got like the whip and the hat, and he's dressed up like Indiana Jones. So you can see embedded within it are like all of these nods and winks to other cultural content of the era and going back still further.
Yeah, I guess maybe we should get on to the scene about the dad and getting stuck in the chimney. The yeah, so that one, to be honest, that's my least favorite part of the movie. I really kind of didn't like that scene. So basically, his girlfriend, she hates Christmas and he doesn't know why. So she's always like miserable at that time of year, and he's trying to find out like how could you hate Christmas? He even there's a scene where he even asks, "Oh, are you a Hindu or something?" It's funny how he didn't say a different religion, but whatever. But then she tells a story that when she was a young girl, her dad said he was going to come home on Christmas Eve, but then he didn't come home. Then he didn't come home on Christmas Day, and then for several days they hadn't even heard of him. And then eventually they tried to light a fire in the fireplace, and they realized that he was stuck in the chimney in a Santa suit, and he had broken his neck and died with a bunch of presents in the chimney. It's really dark stuff. And then she even says at the end, like, "That's how I learned that there was no Santa Claus." And even like again, like there's going to be some parents bringing their kids to this movie. You know, it's a 5 or 6 year old kid. The movie's going to tell them that Santa Claus doesn't exist. You know, that kind of really does dampen the mood of Christmas and stuff. So
It's
yeah,
I think
it's a really kind of mean-spirited scene, I will say.
it totally desacralizes Christmas, and I think it has. Again, you can see like this, you can see that the a lot of the sort of Generation X mindset's being molded by this kind of content. It wasn't just the violence, but it's this kind of decon. This is where the subversion comes in. This is the deconstruction. Another one is when you see Santa Claus is just completely covered in gremlins, being murdered by gremlins, and the cops are just like looking on. But the issue of the girl is especially egregious, I think, because she there's like two parts of it. Earlier in the film, she mentions that for a lot of people, Christmas is a hard time of year. So if you don't have many family and friends, like it is true that the Christmas time has the highest. That's when so many people kill themselves. It because if you don't have many family or friends or anything, and you're left on your own on Christmas, it's. I mean, I've never been in that situation, but I can imagine it would be absolutely horrible. And for some people, it's just too much, and they're so that actually is a thing, and I think that's fair to point out that for a lot of people, Christmas is a bloody miserable time. But then to so you're you and it's that's true. It's hard to disagree with that. But then what they do is kind of bring in the story where it's like, well, that her dad like. And she even mentioned that she they were sitting in the freezing cold because he didn't come home. They didn't have any money, and then they finally went to try and put the fire on, and then they got the smell. So she got the smell of her dead dad dressed up as Santa Claus being stuck in the chimney. Now that's not the same as saying, well, you know, a lot of people have it tough on Christmas because they're lonely. That's one thing I can understand that. But to come out with this ridiculously gory story, which is just not in any way realistic, is yeah, it's an issue. That is an issue, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and that's also why I did wonder, like, you know, was it did it need to be a Christmas movie at the beginning that like I had mentioned, like there's a lot of things in that really or sorry, there's not a lot of things in it that really seem like they need to take place during Christmas. But then when you put it into the context of, well, scenes like this and then like Santa Claus being eaten alive by gremlins, like it feels like, you know, they it feels like kind of it is an attack on Christmas in some ways. Now, I don't know whether that's Spielberg's because it worked because he was the producer. I can't imagine that, you know, like that's something that Christopher Columbus really wanted to do because he was or sorry, Chris Columbus rather, because he was the director of Home Alone, which is a very wholesome Christmas movie. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, like there is that, like you mentioned, the Gen X nihilism, the cynicism towards everything, and like I think that's something that these days has like really run its course for me. That I really kind of don't dislike this kind of attitude. I want there to be something that's like genuine again, and you know, we just haven't been able to, we just haven't been able to recapture that, because it was all kind of deconstructed. It was all turned ironic. It was all mocked. It was all desacralized. And the last two decades of the 20th century and today, we were kind of left without that.
I mean, Jonathan Pajot, as usual, I did a little bit of research on the run-up to it. And there's somebody, there's Jonathan Pajot, I think, is he an Orthodox Christian, is it? Or a Catholic? I'm not sure.
But he's an Orthodox Christian, but I'm not sure.
He hangs out with Jordan Peterson. He's quite a big brain. I don't really understand the symbolism stuff, but he actually says that Gremlins is. I was expecting him to have like a similar take as us, but he's like, you know, more advanced on all of this, the symbolism of it all. And another reading of it, which I thought was interesting, was that it's to do with the solstice and descending into darkness and chaos, which is where the gremlins come in, because they, of course, the light kills the gremlins. And then you get the kind of like the big showdown in the hardware store at the end. And then finally, the father returns and the sun comes up again and like stripes just a puddle of like melted gloop on the floor. And he tied it all in with all of this Saturn and everything. And I thought, well, okay. So, and his point was that, yeah, you can see it as being subversive. But at the same time, when you just take a step back and look at the story of it all, there's something else in there as well, which is perhaps quite a bit more Christian what people realize. But I'll put that out there. I'm not sure if I'm entirely convinced by it, because it is one of those movies where you can just kind of take out whatever you want. Because you could like focus just on the Americana and the how nice the town is, but it's dishonest. If you're not going to bring up the dad and the dead dad and a chimney and all of that stuff, you know.
Yeah, I watched his video as well. It certainly was interesting. I didn't think about all these things while I was watching the film, but it's certainly a fascinating interpretation that kind of like the gremlins are the coming of the dark, and then at the end the light begins to return, because Christmas is near the winter solstice. So if, like that, I know that, and it's this. I think it's technically December 21st is the actual winter solstice, that the nights keep getting longer and longer until that point. And then from that point on, they get lighter and lighter again. It's an interesting interpretation, but I don't know, maybe I guess I'm not as cued in on these things as history would be.
My general take is that it is a commentary on consumerism and materialism in America. It's not the most sophisticated of takes on it, but I think you've got to be careful about like reading too much into some of these movies. You know, there's like a trope, which it's because of the books that I've been reading on, which have just been straightforward fiction. And when you look at some of the rubbish which is coming out now, in like the, you know, what nerd YouTube would complain about, it's one of the things which I do find interesting, which they say, is that a writer cannot write characters smarter than what they are. So if you are in a writer is limited in what they can do, because it's impossible to write a character who can do more, like make more sophisticated plans than what you can in your own head. Because you've got like there's like a hard stop on it, and this is why. So the something like the Amazon atrocity, which has just bombed. One of the things that Nerd YouTube have been pointing out is that the actual writers at Amazon are just not smart enough to deal with this material. So and what was interesting was that it came out with the latest George R. Martin House of the Dragon thing, which had its own issues with some of the diversity. But the characters and the plots and stuff were much more sophisticated. And it was because you had this kind of fat old white man helming it all and drafting it all out. But when they were on the Amazon stuff, all they had was like the barest bits of like Tolkien, which they were allowed to use. But the main point of it is that when you're looking at the characters in it, what they say and what they do is not complicated. It's not nuanced. It's not sophisticated. There's no complicated plots or storylines because the writers aren't smart enough to do that. And I think even though the writers in 80s Hollywood were a lot more sophisticated than what we have now, at the same time, I'm not sure if they were sophisticated enough to have some kind of deep occultic like symbolism in like a kid's monster movie like this. I know people will kind of push back on that and say actually almost all Hollywood is dabbling in the occult, and I don't buy it. I think people are looking at like taking what they're reading, what they want. They're just kind of imposing their own priors onto it. And I do think it's fair to say that the main message of Gremlins is consumerism and technology and materialism. I mean, he literally calls Gizmo is like called Gizmo. A Gizmo is a piece of technology that we don't really understand, that we don't know how it works. It's just a little gadget. And this is what, so he's taken this ancient creature from some mystical Far East and reduced it to like a calculator or a kettle or all of those gadgets which he himself has made, which don't work. And the message is, well, actually, no, you can't. This is completely the wrong approach. And like, I don't. I think that's a fair commentary as well. To be honest, I think it is a fair critique of like just stuff. Just because we complain about it all now, I don't see why that as a criticism of Americanism, and or more specifically neoliberalism, I think it's valid. If I'm honest, why does everywhere on earth has to be turned into a Walmart and a McDonald's? I'm on board with that as a criticism.
Yeah, I guess my take on it was that it's not that deep, because I do think like, you know, the technology isn't really like the main villain in the movie. It is this like kind of like mystical creature from the outside. But you know, they have these some commentary on that with like the gremlins being the ones who are messing up the machinery in World War II and stuff like that. I'd say that my take on it is that it's kind of just meant to be this fun comedy horror movie from the 80s, and it has like a few of these themes which are kind of typical of the era, that being like the critiques of Reaganism and consumerism, and it has a few things about technology and then a few things about about creatures and the mystical. But I would say that I can't really hammer down the film as a very strong commentary on one of these particular areas. I mean, it's the only time I've seen it, so maybe if I watched it again, I'd be able to get a clearer picture. But yeah, overall, you know, it is kind of just interesting film from the 80s. To be honest, it's not one of my favorite Christmas movies, but it certainly has a lot to talk about. And there's a lot of themes in there.
Ugly Truth points out in the chat that when the Mogwai first get covered in water and they multiply, then after you'd expect the father to be like horrified by it, but in actual fact what he does is think like this could be the big one, we can market these, if we can just like put a drop of water on, we've got another one, there's an unending supply, and he says we can market it as the Pelzer pet. Everything will be reduced to an item, a consumer item. And the message is like, well, no, it won't. It's going to blow up in your face because you don't know what you're doing is running against the forces of nature. It's a bit sort of ham-fisted, you know. You could do that. You could have these themes in the movie, but then like you've literally got this kind of mystical old Chinaman like pointing it out, like literally just saying it. You didn't listen. You let him watch television, which is another thing there, because the part of this, and it part of it is that the television and what Gizmo is watching is influencing his behavior as well. So at the end, he watches, it's yet another movie. I don't know which one it is, but it's Clark Gable, I think. And it's some kind of film about car racing. And he kind of loves it. And then later he acts that out. So it's as if like the Americans are also being brainwashed by the media at the same time that everything's being reduced to a consumerist product. But here you get a sort of meta analysis, because Gremlins is doing that itself with the kind of subversion, you know, the dead dad in the chimney, Santa Claus being clawed to death by Gremlins. So this is where you do get into like postmodern territory, where it's like a commentary on a commentary on a commentary. The Gremlins itself is doing that. Gremlins itself is desensitizing kids to violence. It is like desacralizing Christmas. It is making people think about death on Christmas and all of this. And it's doing it in this perfect setting. And then at the end of it, you're going to have the mystical Chinese man say, well, the Americans are sort of, you're brainwashing yourselves with television. You should, why did you let him watch television? And the idea is that, well, Gizmo is this innocence from outside. He is from the old mystical world. And to have him brainwashed by TV, like what you do with yourselves, is this terrible thing. So that you've got all these different layers of what's going on there, which is typical of the era, I think.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's interesting that, like we spoke about earlier, how the 80s was kind of like a hearkening back to the 1950s, how there's the similarities between the town in Gremlins and the town in A Wonderful Life, which came out in the 1940s. And there was even the scene where they're watching that. And, you know, there's the boomers in the 1980s are dreaming about when they were young as kids in the 1950s. It feels like, you know, we're going through this cycle again, whereas today there's a movie critic YouTube. They're obsessed with the 1990s and the 1980s about going back to like this kind of earlier form, whereas even at that time in the 1980s, it was also going back to a previous form. And it seems like we're just like constantly stuck on this cycle. I saw this on Telegram. I'm not going to watch this or anything, but I saw that they were going to, you know, the show That 70s Show from the 90s. It was a sitcom that took place in the 70s. And I think it came out in the 90s and the 2000s. Well, I heard that they're going to make That 90s Show, and they're going to recast the actors are all going to be 20 years older in the 1990s. And like, it's just, you see this throughout our entire culture, like that it's just, we're always just like stuck in this, like in this one time period. And I do wonder, has that ever happened before? Cause I know that there's been times in history where people have hearkened back to something before, you know. There was in the 18th century, people were really fascinated with the classical world, and they built buildings with pillars and domes. And in the 19th century, people loved medieval stuff. They built neo-Gothic things. But like today, it just seems like we're just stuck in this like a loop of the last like 40 or 50 years or so, and nothing new can be created. I mean, this movie is what, almost 40 years old now? Yeah. And they had Indiana Jones in this movie as like this thing that at this point was a cultural phenomenon. Next year, they're going to be making another Indiana Jones movie with the same actor who's in his 80s now, 40 years later. And it's just like, it's impossible to escape this loop.
Yeah, there's a lot there. But it's funny you should mention Indiana Jones, because I was actually planning on writing an article, just like a sort of quick piece on, I watched the trailer for Indiana Jones. They've had to de-age him. There's a woman in there as well now. And rumor has it, it's going to be this weird time continuum thing where Indiana Jones just doesn't exist. And all of it was some kind of, I don't know, like alternate universe. And it's the woman who is like the real Indiana Jones. I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know if that's true. But Indiana Jones especially, I think I'll just say it here instead of like doing an article about it. is that when you get the Raiders of the Lost Ark, what's funny about it, you know, is that there's a scene in it where he meets Marion, who, by the way, is just stunningly sexy and beautiful in that, in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And there's history between them. And at this time, I think Harrison Ford would have been in his late 30s. And when they meet up again in like the Himalayas or wherever it is, she actually, there's history between them, and the story is that she was a young girl and they had a bit of a fling, and her father was outraged by it, and it was a whole drama. But like she says to Indiana Jones, "You're not the man that I used to be," or something like that. And he has this memorable line where he says, "It's not the years, honey, it's the mileage." But what's implied by it is that even in Raiders of the Lost Ark, like Indiana Jones was seen to be kind of world weary, and he'd been around quite a bit, and you know he was just a little bit past his best. When you get to the Last Crusade, Sean Connery is his father, and Sean Connery is like, I think he was only about 12 years older than what like Harrison Ford actually is in real life. But yeah, it touches back to what I was saying earlier about the authority figure in Gremlins, where Mr. Peltzer, because at least in Last Crusade, the idea was that there is an authority figure. Sean Connery was, he would you know, slap him down and be the boss of Indiana Jones. That's why it was amusing to see. But what's happened is that that's never actually taken place with Indiana Jones. So he never enters into the role of senior. He's trapped forever, even to the point where they have to de-age him when he's long, long past the age that Sean Connery was in The Last Crusade.
Oh, yeah, so I was going to comment on this too. Like, not only is he older, he's 22 years older than Sean Connery was when he made Last Crusade, when he was supposed to be the old man.
Yeah. So you never actually, and then if you take a step back and you look at the movie itself, you're never actually in a position where you've grown up. I mean, I saw something on Twitter where it was like, it said something like Indiana Jones is a movie for 35-year-old men who refuse to grow up or whatever. But the problem is, like, it isn't even that. If you were like 22, if you were 20 years old and you went on a date to see Raiders of the Lost Ark, you're going to be in your early 60s now. And the problem here is that this is kids' entertainment. It's entertainment for young people, but it's now like people well into their 60s. There's no progression. And if you went back further, you could at least say that in the 1950s, you know, I went through a phase recently where I was watching film noir a lot, the old film noir stuff from the 50s. And in it, it's got very mature themes. Like a man in his 70s who's lived a full life can watch a film noir and get something out of it because there is a maturity to it. There's this kind of world-weary cynicism which is settled in. There's a masculine element to it which isn't youthful and childish. There's a maturity to it. And in our world now, that hasn't materialized. There's nothing you can turn to, which is to say that, well, this is what, this is a cultural form for a mature man, a patriarch. It doesn't exist. They're going back to 1980s to try and relive it all. So and as for the idea where say you'd go, the romantics would hark back to the classic world. We're talking just decades here. We're just talking a few decades. We're completely trapped in this paradigm of like they should have called it like Indiana Jones and the Elixir of Permanent Adolescence, because that's what we're stuck in. At least with like Clint Eastwood. I mean, like, I wouldn't say that any of Clint Eastwood's movies really are specifically designed for young boys. there's a much more, there's like something mature and manly in all of it. But then when he did say The Unforgiven, that was specifically to say I'm older now, and those crazy spaghetti westerns where I'm just shooting everybody on the screen, like that time has been gone. And so again, like a man in his 60s can watch something like The Unforgiven and feel as if he's like, well, yeah, it'll resonate with him. He can relate to this, that kind of maturity and this kind of looking back on your life, contemplating a life that's been, you know. And this isn't possible if you're stuck in your youth forever. And that's exactly what that Indiana Jones represents.
Yeah, I was my joke title was Indiana Jones and the Curse of the Undead Culture.
Yeah, it's the culture is totally zombified. I mean, at least in something like James Bond, they're going to switch the actor every 10 years. So he's always, James Bond is like permanently in his 40s or late 30s. But in Indiana Jones, they're just desperately trying to squeeze one more movie out before he dies. It's depressing. I think this is unique to us. It's being stuck in this time loop.
And the other thing I thought of is that Christmas is also something that seems to be stuck in this time loop, because all of the like Christmas classics that we have, none of them are new. I think that the newest Christmas movie that I consider to be a Christmas classic is Jouer Noël, the one about the World War I Christmas truce. But think about all the films that are popular at this time of year. It's a Wonderful Life, Home Alone, Gremlins, ones like this, A Christmas Carol. None of them are new. Like, and all the Christmas music that we're listening to, it's all from the 50s and 60s. Nothing. And this Mariah Carey song, when did that come out? The 90s or something like that? The early 2000s? Yeah, like all of the Christmas stuff that we're bombarded with every year, it's all old. So there's no new stuff being produced for this stuff. Now, there are people that are trying to do it, but none of it sticks. None of it becomes that new Christmas holiday classic that people watch every year. So we're just stuck with watching the same stuff over and over again ad infinitum, because we can't create anything new anymore.
We can't create something which is genuinely authentic. And one of the reasons we can't is because we are stuck with all of this sort of cultural signifiers of the past, where whatever you do is going to remain, is going to, if you look at Gremlins is a perfect example, where everything in Gremlins is consciously supposed to be. And in Gremlins 2, it's much worse. It's in Gremlins 2, it's just totally obvious what they're doing. They're commenting on Hollywood itself. And it's in that in Gremlins 1 as well, but toned down to a degree. But what you begin to see is that it's like all of these symbols of Indiana Jones, of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The town looks like the town from A Wonderful Life. Then you've got Gizmo driving the car, and it's like signifies him watching the movie, the earlier movie. And so this is kind of like the culture writ large. How do you actually create something which is authentic and genuinely new? And nobody knows how to do it, because everything is like something else. Everything will remind you, to the degree where people will go walking in the woods and they'll say, oh, look at this, it's like Skyrim. Or you know, it's you go walking through a city, you know, high-tech city, skyscrapers. Oh, look at this, it's like Blade Runner. Everything reminds you of another form of media. So we're completely trapped in this borderline sort of hellscape where authenticity can't come forward, or is very difficult to do. I mean, this is, you know, it's going off on a bit of a tangent, but one, this is something like sort of Heidegger was trying to address way back in the day, even. But that would take us too far afield. There's been a few super chats come in, so I think I'll hit them. Unless you've got anything to add on Gremlins.
No, I'm good to go to the super chats.
All right. So did the one from Hungry Haggis before. Major Dolby's cat got me two coffees. I'll say it again, Morgoth. Your voice and content is extremely inspiring to me, both politically and popular culture. Love the films you and Endeavor discuss. The most recent Gremlins. Thank you and enjoy a couple of pints this festive season. All the best. Well, thank you very much for that, Dolby's cat. We do try. I mean, one of the things with classic movies, and that it's difficult because you want a movie. It would be easy to just get a great old Christmas Carol movie from, you know, 1940 or something, and then just praise it to death. But I think what I try to do is when you look at something like Gremlins, there's a lot to dig into. There's a lot to get your brain going when you put it into a larger context. So, and that's kind of what I go for. I mean, I'll probably never watch Gremlins again, if I'm honest. I was kind of disappointed with it, but it does allow you to get into something. Another thing that I forgot to mention is, you know, I've mentioned this before, but it's in Gremlins, we see the problem again with the centrist nerd YouTube, like movie critics, is that they want, this is a golden era for them. So, you know, they hate all the woke stuff that's out now, but they love, say, Predator, because it's mixed race, but it isn't political. And this is the case in with Gremlins, and there's just a general sort of idealism. And so the sort of the modern classic liberal, in my opinion, which I've stated before and I'll say it again, they are not really bothered about Locke. They are not, they're not interested in John Locke and all of this stuff. What they are really after is the 1980s and the 1990s, and what is represented in something like Gremlins. That's what they desperately yearn for. And at my Substack, and it's public, I did a quite a lengthy essay last week on centrist Caesarism, which gets into this a lot more. And so this the problem with this is, of course, and you can take Gremlins as an example, is that if you think things in the 1980s were so much better than all of the woke crap that we have now, and then you kind of go all out and you bring it in. Predator, yeah, I see some of Predator is great. I love it. But when on Gremlins, you can say, well, we can go back to this era when everything just was so much better. And it was better. But this is when we've broken it down in Gremlins, it isn't like culture just stays static. It isn't like you can go back. So when you go back to Gremlins and you think, well, yeah, it looks wholesome. It looks like paradise to live in that little American town. There's no identity politics, as they would see it. There's the black science guy is there, but he isn't sort of into BLM and all of this. But what you can see is the subtle undermining of the sacredness of Christmas. It's the way that the poison pill about her dead dad in the chimney is dropped into the poison in the well. So if you go back to that era, you're still left with like the pause. It may be like embryonic in form, but it is there, and it's still going to metastasize as the years go on. This is the problem with that worldview.
Yeah, I mean the classic liberal centrist race blind civic nationalism view is that it's going to be an entirely white town, except there's going to be one black guy and he's going to be a genius scientist.
Yeah, because this is livable. This is fine. But the problem is it was a creation of Hollywood. It always was a fiction. And this is what their sort of ideal is, you know?
Yeah, and then if you look up like the crime wave during the 1980s and the early 90s, this era that these people idolized, well, let me just say that the people committing these crimes, they weren't, genius scientists who are going to tell you what this mythical creature's biological components are.
Yeah, so thanks for that. And I'm going to go on. I'm just going to refresh the page, yeah. I finally figured out how to do these properly because I'm not used to streaming that much. So Fionnir, That's very Nordic, and that's Icelandic krona, I think. He sent two. I don't know how much that is, but thank you very much anyway. Oh, wait there. I need to see them all. And he says, 8 globalists, 8 technocrats, 8 maggot burgers, love Spengler, love me Shires, love England, simple as. Absolutely. That's pretty much my whole worldview summed up there. And he sends another one for 1500, so thanks again. The Norths are the pinnacle of creation. For them, the great struggle is won. They have evolved a society that knows no stress or angst. We see a strong culture and despise it as crude. I think he means like sort of back in the day. It's possible. I'm not sure what you mean by that. But I'm actually about to read a book on my list called Something About the North Wind. It's I forgot the proper name now. Beyond the North Wind, I think it's called. And it's a sort of a book all about the North Sea, the Scotland, the North, and the history of it in a mythological sense. So I'll probably be doing, I think I'll make that a real effort video some point in the new year when I get through it. Blacklisted just sends £5. Thank you very much. Jay, another £5. Thanks a lot. And I suggest you add Bergman's The Virgin Spring to the list set in medieval Sweden. Main theme is revenge. It's one of Frodi's fave films, incidentally. I don't know much about Bergman. I've heard so much about those Bergman films. I've never watched any of them. It's terrible. It's really bad form from me. And I think that is about it. Well, that's pretty much Gremlins. And I think this is going to be the online safety bill. Well, the political stuff is... Yeah, I'll get into all of that on on me normal standard stuff. It will be a little bit off topic, but I think it's a nightmare. And we've got all of these things coming down the track for next year. And this is going to be the last Christmas. This is going to be the last classic movie stream of the year. I think I may do a little solo stream over the next few weeks or something, and a sort of thanks to everybody who supported me over the year, and sort of a cozy, more relaxed just roundup when I'll talk with the chat, and we'll just have a bit of banter and maybe treat myself to a tot of whiskey. But I think that's it. It's been a pretty brutal year, to be honest. And I don't know if next year is going to be much better, but it's nice to do these like cozy streams sometimes, because God knows I've done some bleak content this year. So have you got any idea what you'll be doing in the new year endeavor?
Yeah, I wanted to do one eventually on the movie How the West Was Won. And I also wanted to do one of the versus streams that we do where we compare two films. I wanted to do one comparing Mutiny on the Bounty to HMS Defiant. Both are movies about mutinies on ships in the late 18th century, and I think they're really interesting. They have really interesting contrasts, so that'd be an idea for the future.
All right. So, I think I will do a solo sort of roundup stream for the year. I'm not the biggest fan of live streams, but then when I do one like this, I think, yeah, why not? Thanks for your movie analysis stream. I really enjoy these and always learn a lot. Yeah, I love them as well. It's love to, they act as great springboards to say, kind of go off on different directions and all of that. So, right, lads. I'll say lads because I haven't seen a single woman in the chat, except one that slagged us off at the start, said I was wasting time on this kind of content. So Merry Christmas to you as well. And I'll say Merry Christmas to the lads, but I think I might be back in a week or two. Catch
Merry
you
Christmas.
Later. Merry Christmas.